I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Robert Hammond, co-founder of Friends of the High Line, an organization that pioneered the transformation of an elevated train line into a public space about a mile and a half long on the west side of New York City. Robert co-founded Friends of the High Line with Joshua David, whom he met at a community board meeting to protest the High Line's demolition in 1999. The park opened to the public in 2009. Robert and Josh are the authors of the book The High Line, the inside story of New York City's Park in the Sky. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
What does the High Line look like?
Well, I mean, it was originally an old elevated rail line. So, you know, when I first saw it, it was sort of this resting structure. But now we've cleaned it up a little bit, and there's a park on top. So you're about three stories in the air walking through the city, you know, sometimes through buildings, and it gives you just all these different perspectives on the city.
Now, the High Line was first created in the 1930s as a safety mechanism, because you had trains at street level who were killing people, basically running them over. And then they were abandoned by 1980s. Why were they abandoned?
Because with the rise of interstate trucking, the line was used less and less. And, you know, its heyday was really, you know, right after it was built, 30s, 40s. But by the 60s, it was used less and less. And the last train was a trainload of frozen turkeys that ran at Thanksgiving, around right before Thanksgiving in 1980. So it wasn't that long ago that it was still, you know, an active train line. But, you know, and the trains ran, when you're saying people were killed, 10th Avenue was nicknamed Death Avenue because so many people were run over by the trains. And the railroad hired a guy on horseback to run in front of the trains, and he became nicknamed the West Side Cowboy.
What other deliveries were made, aside from frozen turkeys, to these buildings along the High Line?
I mean, it was actually a lot of food. The nickname for the High Line was the lifeline of New York because it brought in a lot of food to Manhattan. And a lot of the buildings that are still next to the High Line used to be windowless refrigerated warehouses. And now they're offices and residences, and they punched windows through. Also, the Nabisco factory, which is now Chelsea Market at 15th Street, you know, they were baking cookies. You know, the train would actually bring in the eggs and the flours, and then the trains would take out the Oreos that would go all over the U.S.
So in 1999, the city and developers and residents were planning to demolish the High Line, and you attended a community board meeting to help protest this demolition. What were you doing at that moment in your life?
I was working for a watch retailer and helping them launch an internet division, sort of right during the internet boom. So my background was in, you know, for-profit startups, a lot of internet companies. And I read an article in the Times that the High Line was going to be demolished, and had a little map, and it showed that it was a mile and a half long. And I'd seen parts of it, but I just thought it was all chopped up. And so that's when I thought, wow, this is, you know, a mile and a half of Manhattan. You know, that doesn't come around very often.
You mentioned this was in the 1990s, mm-hmm. and this was the heyday of internet startups, which helped 20-somethings like yourself, you know, think that they could run these multi-million-dollar companies. How much was that in your psychology of wanting to think big for yourself?
Oh, I think it was a huge part. Early 20-year-olds were taking companies public for hundreds of millions of dollars. So, you know, it didn't bother me that I didn't have any experience necessarily. But, you know, when we were starting it, I thought my role and Josh's role would just be to get it started, and then someone else would do it. But pretty quickly we found out some people might have been excited, but they didn't want to take it on.
You take a year off every 10 years. It just so happened that when you were thinking about starting this project for the High Line, it coincided with one of your years off. Can you describe how you decided ultimately to take that year to
Yeah, I mean, it's not a scientific process. It's just when I was in college, I met my boyfriend, or my first boyfriend, or the first guy I ever kissed, and we were not out of the closet. We didn't know what to do, so we dropped out of college told our parents we were taking a year off. And we ended up moving to Hong Kong and doing construction work and traveling in Southeast Asia, worked on the stock exchange here, and just, it was a great year. I mean, it was an amazing year. It was so helpful. And that's when I made the promise to myself that I would try every 10 years or so, you know, to take some time off for myself. And then, you know, so it was really sort of a, I think, a coincidence there. When I started, I was 29, and that watch retailer later in the year got bought out by Sunglass Hut. So I made a little bit of money and had enough money to take a year off, and I thought I would travel and figure out what I wanted to do next, but ended up staying in New York and focusing mostly on the High Line. And was really enjoying it. But I still thought, oh, this is just something I'll do, you know, just during this year off.
And to what extent was your opposition to wanting to take this on initially the fact that you'd be running a nonprofit or, you know, socially minded organization versus a for-profit organization?
I mean, I definitely had never had any desire to run a nonprofit. You know, I'd never had any desire to go to a community board meeting before I went to that one. So, you know, that was part of it. I just didn't also think running a nonprofit could be that interesting. And that was a huge mistake.
Right.
And it's actually very similar to startups. Because, you know, when you're in a startup, more than half of your time is consumed by raising money. And that's the same thing in nonprofit. The problem is, you know, in a for-profit, either you stop making money, you go under. Nonprofit, the more successful you are, the more money you have to raise.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Robert Hammond, the co-founder of Friends of the High Line, an organization that pioneered the creation of the High Line, an elevated public park in New York City. You went to Princeton, and you weren't openly gay until mid-college. What was that like for you growing up in Texas knowing that you were gay? Or did you not know at the time?
I don't know. I mean, I definitely knew, but I didn't really think about it that much. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was really fortunate to come out at a time when I did, because it was a very much easier, you know, in the early 90s to come out than mm-hmm. I think even, you know, 5 years before. My parents were very supportive. My family was really supportive. And my friends were really supportive. So it really wasn't. And then I moved to New York, where it's pretty easy.
Your parents were involved in civic-minded projects when you were growing up in San Antonio. For instance, your father helped to found Friends of the Parks in San Antonio. Is it accidental that you came to this place, or how did that inform what you're doing now?
Yeah, I mean, for a long time, I always thought the High Line reminded me of my mother, because my mother was always interested in odd projects and sort of taught me from a young age to see, sort of find beauty in odd places. And then it was, I don't know, maybe like 3 or 4, it might have been 5 years after I'd been working on the High Line that I realized that the things that my dad, when I was growing up, the things my dad did outside of work were he was involved in preservation, parks, and architecture. And, you know, here I was working on a project that combined all three of those things. You know, so I think I was sort of slow to see, and he was kind enough not to point it out.
Which implies a healthy relationship with your parents.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty lucky. I think I have had an atypical Texan childhood. I became obsessed with Russia when I was in middle school after reading Nicholas and Alexandra. And my parents let me go to Russia when I was in middle school by myself. And then they let me live over there for 3 years in high school in 87, which, you know, wasn't what most Texan parents, you know, wanted their kid to go live in the Soviet Union at the time.
What do your siblings do? You have a brother and a sister.
Yeah, my brother is an Episcopal priest in Fredericksburg, and he lives there with his wife and two kids.
In Texas,
yeah. And my sister lives in Dallas, and she has 4 kids.
You mentioned that when you were doing the project, it seemed obvious to you that you were paralleling your mom's eccentric life to some degree. Your mom, for instance, kept bees in your living room in Texas, and she was also a kite maker and collector. Talk to me about that.
Yeah. The year I was born, she heard about the National Kite Flying Championship that happens on the Mall. The Smithsonian hosts it every year. She'd never really done anything before, but the rule was you had to make your own kite and fly it yourself. So she made a kite and went to Washington, and she won the National Kite Flying Championship. And then went on to collect, I think one time she had the largest collection of kites in the United States. She had several shows, made some making her own kites. And then, you know, she would, every few years, she would get a new hobby. from collecting brooms to animal vertebras to, you know.
Whistles.
She doesn't whistle. I mean, you could probably name a top collection, the downstairs bathroom, the bathtub is filled with all different devices that make bubbles.
I read a quote. She said, "A kite and a person have many similarities. They both have skin and bones and rely on the same thing to get them going, air."
Yeah. When she said when I was... She loved the name Highline because high of kite flying. And she, there's, I don't know if it was her quote or someone else's, but she always used to say, it's hard to have bad thoughts when you're looking up. That like when you look down, one, you're usually not as happy, but it also makes you more unhappy. When you look up, you're just sort of already either happier or it makes you a little happier. And that's something, you know, that's connected to the Highline.
I want to go back to 1999 when you heard about this potential demolition of the High Line. You went to this community board meeting just as a concerned citizen in the West Village, and you happened to be sitting next to this guy, Joshua David, who became your partner. Did you both come up with the idea, you know, let's start this, or was it more of a eventual process?
It was more like, oh, you know, here's my business card. Oh, here's, you know, we exchanged business cards. And I said, well, I'm really busy. Why don't you do something? And I'll help. And he was like, well, I'm busier. You do it and I'll help, you know. Mm-hmm. So we were like, okay, well, let's talk.
David is a writer. And at the time, he was writing for magazines ranging from...
Yeah, Travel and Leisure, Gourmet, Wallpaper.
Were you at all in any way strange bedfellows?
Yeah, well, I think one of the reasons it worked is we are so different. His background was in writing and magazines. Mine was in startups. I think that's one of the things that has made it work is that we were precisely so different and that neither of us had any experience in planning, architecture. You know, that most people assume we were architects.
At what point did you say, you know what, we don't have a background in this. Let's come up with this competition.
From the beginning, we always said, he and I are not going to decide this. And that's why it was great that we weren't architects. I think if we had been architects, it would have been irresistible for us to want to design it.
Who were the architects for the project?
So it was led by James Corner Field Operations, who's a landscape architect. And he partnered with James Diller Scofidio and Renfro architects. And also Pete Uldoff, who is the garden designer who picked a lot of the plants.
They became the designers of the project as a result of a competition that you held. And some other ideas in the competition ranged from a mile-long swimming pool to a roller coaster. What other ideas were there?
There was one idea where it was called a park prison. And the idea was sort of a political manifesto is that we should have to see the people that we imprison. So you'd have a park on the High Line, and in the I-beams in the middle, you would imprison people. So as you're having your leisure stroll, you'd also have to see people in prison. I mean, my favorite was the pool. This, because it was such a clean idea, this mile-long lap pool. And imagine, you know, swimming, you know, no lap turns. And then in the winter, it would become a mile-and-a-half skating rink.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Robert Hammond, co-founder of Friends of the High Line. We'll hear more from Robert coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Robert Hammond, co-founder of Friends of the High Line, an organization that pioneered the transformation of an elevated train line into a public space about a mile and a half long on Manhattan's West Side in New York City. Friends of the High Line relies on support from members to fund the ongoing maintenance of the park, as well as the expansion of its third section to be completed in 2014. The design for the High Line was determined through this competition that you held. In what way was opening this up to the public strategic?
There was one of our early supporters, a guy, Phil Ahrens, and he said, you know, don't show people designs. And it was one of the best pieces of advice. And I always, whenever I'm talking to people that are starting their own projects, everyone wants to rush to get into the design and show what it's going to look like. And, you know, I think there was a real advantage not to, because people could... then imagine things that they want to see up there. And that's when we had this photographer, Joel Sternfeld, go up and shoot the High Line. And Josh and I think of him as almost sort of the third co-founder, because he took these photos that sold the project for us. You know, you could look at it and say, well, you know, it's just an abandoned railroad with weeds growing on it. But, you know, it's weeds growing on an abandoned rail track with the Empire State Building in the background. So this is Manhattan. And so, you know, people looked at that and saw all different things. Some people saw a chance to build something. Some people saw a chance for a garden. Some people saw perennials. Some people saw the wild grasses. Some people saw preservation. Some people thought train. You know, it enabled us to really create a broad group of support, not just sort of a narrow, you know, just architects or just preservationists.
So the lack of specificity really helped to facilitate this current of interest.
Yeah. But what the beauty of it is that it all came back, actually, ironically, to that very photo. When we asked people in the community, what did they want? They pointed to Joel's photo. And the beauty of what the design team did was they didn't just make it look exactly like that. They captured the spirit and the feeling of what was up there, but also added something new.
Ironically, the opposition to the project was almost helpful to you.
Yeah.
Can you describe that paradox?
Yeah. Well, at first when we came on board, you know, we really didn't know who we were up against. But then it became pretty clear that the city, led by Mayor Giuliani, was against it. He signed a demolition order 3 days before he left office. The property owners in the neighborhood had been organizing to tear it down for years. And actually, a lot of people in the neighborhood, you know, just thought it was an eyesore. Even if they thought it would be nice if it was a park, they thought, these two guys are never going to make it happen, so you should just get it over with and tear it down. But, you know, my elevator pitch was, it's a mile and a half Manhattan. How often do you get a chance to think about that? I'd show them the Joel Sternfeld photo. If that didn't work, I could always say, and Giuliani hates it. And then people go, oh, really? Then it must be a great idea. I'd be happy to help.
When did you become more and more certain that actually, you know what, this is something that can happen despite the intransigence of this prior?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was one of the last people to believe that it would really happen. I mean, I'm a dreamer, but I'm also a realist and knew the chances from the beginning were very small. And then as we started making a lot of progress, we had just so many, it was so complex with so many legal, financial, regulatory, and political hurdles and just engineering problems that I was just convinced it wouldn't have taken a lot for it all to fall apart. I mean, Josh and I, part of the one thing that we're very much alike is we always sort of worrying and seeing the problems coming up. So we had a development director one time who said she was the only organization she'd ever been at. When you got a $1 million check, we just kept our heads down and kept typing on the computer and kept working. And it's still, it's now just still sinking in that this actually not only happened, but is actually working, you know, that people are liking it.
You obviously faced just an abundance of opposition. What were some of the darkest, like, personal moments for you? Like, did it ever get to a point where you just didn't like what you were doing?
Yeah. You know, I mean, for me, I like the process. The times I would get really upset and lose sleep, it was always interpersonal things.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, when Josh and I weren't getting along, you know, we've had our ups and downs. Most people, you know, assume that we're sort of best friends, and it's been really tough. And there's been several points in the project where we didn't think we could keep working together. And, you know, those were always in some ways the hardest time for me.
In the early days, you took the stance of you were neighborhood nobodies, you know, which...
Well, no, I didn't take... Someone called us neighborhood nobodies.
But you kind of ran with it.
Yeah.
What's that quote? Don't be so humble. You're not that great yet.
Yeah. No, we definitely play the humble game. We definitely play that game a little bit.
Yet, even though you played that game, you were quite professional and quite deliberate about certain things, one of which was hiring lawyers versus asking lawyers to work pro bono for you.
Well, I mean, one of the things I think most nonprofits or maybe anybody, you know, is loath to do is pay lawyers a lot of money. But at the time, we needed to sue the city on a very specific rail use and land use issue, and the lawyers that could do it pro bono weren't the best in that area. And the lawyers that were the best are usually hired by the city or the railroad, and they didn't want to do it pro bono. So that's when we realized, you know, that's how developers get things done. They hire the really smart lawyers. And so we wanted to take a page from that book. The High Line wouldn't be standing today if it wasn't for those lawyers. And we had to pay. We had to pay a lot of money. And that's in the early days. It wasn't that glamorous, but that's what we were raising money for, was to pay these lawyers to stop the demolition.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Robert Hammond, co-founder of Friends of the High Line, an organization that pioneered the transformation of an elevated train line in New York City into a public space. I want to talk a little bit more about the opposition. Why was opposition to keeping the High Line so fierce? And what was one impediment that disappeared that kind of helped to open the floodgates?
Well, the High Line was a railroad CSX owned the High Line. But all they owned was the steel structure and a 30-foot easement above it. So there were 22 property owners that owned property underneath it and air rights above it. And they thought it would eventually come down, so they just wanted to tear it down. So that's why there was such opposition and a lot of money involved, because these developers, you know, had bought property hoping the High Line would come down so they could develop in that space. I mean, one of the developers said they spent over $3 million in legal fees fighting us. And then, you know, some people in the community, you know, to me, how romantic, a train running through your neighborhood. The reality was not romantic. It was dirty. It was loud. It smelled. You didn't live on the wrong side of the tracks. You lived under the tracks. And in some cases, their buildings had been demolished because they were worth more for parking than as buildings. So it had sort of put the neighborhood in a deep freeze, which for some people like me is interesting, but from an economic standpoint, you know, is not sustainable in a city like this. So a lot of people wanted to tear the High Line down and get on with it. And that's where Amanda Burden, who is the planning chair for the Bloomberg administration, came in and did a rezoning that allowed the property rights to be transferred within a district. It's what saved, you know, most people think it's Jackie O that saved Grand Central, which she did. But the legal mechanism was they allowed the railroad that owned Grand Central, ironically, to transfer their development rights anywhere in the neighborhood. Normally, you can only transfer it to your neighbor. It also saved the theaters in Times Square in the 90s. You know, it's used very infrequently. But Amanda passed this very complicated rezoning that allowed these developers to actually make money off owning property under the High Line. And then that's what got them on board.
Who were some of your unlikely supporters in the early days?
Well, we had Florent, but I mean, that didn't surprise. You know, Florent had this restaurant on Gansevoort Street that really was one of the early pioneers in the meat market. And he put us in touch with Diane von Furstenberg, who had a store in the neighborhood.
The designer married to Barry Diller, who runs Interactive Corporation.
Yeah, and her son and Barry, you know, really got behind the project and was one of our first really big, you know, financial supporters. Edward Norton was another one, the actor. He read an article that Adam Gopnik wrote about Joel's photos of the High Line that was in the New Yorker, and he read it and looked us up in information and called up Josh. And Josh was just sort of talking to him, and he said, Edward Norton. And then halfway through, he said, are you? And he said, yes, I'm Edward Norton, the actor. And so he said, oh, I really want to help. He mailed us a check right away, would show up at meetings, go to community board meetings. I mean, he actually really dug in.
You also had a lot of support from the gay community in the West Village. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, Josh and I are both gay. And, you know, I think we thought traditionally, you know, nonprofits were run by people on the Upper East Side that you see in the style section of the New York Times, or, you know, just famous rich people. And in the beginning, they weren't that interested in this project. So we tapped the people that we knew, which was our friends, which was a lot of gay people. I mean, one of my straight friends from college came to one of our first events, and he was like, wow, there are a lot of men here. You know, he didn't get it was all gay men except him. Herbert Muschamp, who was the old architecture critic for the Times, has this great quote about the story of preservation in New York is the alliance of gay men and rich women, straight women.
Speaking of straight women, there was a woman, Betsy Barlow Rogers, who founded the Central Park Conservancy. She was helpful to you.
Well, I mean, one, it's great. She's from San Antonio, my hometown. She went to high school with my dad. What she did is she created a private group that partnered with the Parks Department and the city to turn around Central Park and then help run it. And so, you know, without that precedent, the High Line was so unlikely, I don't think we could have ever pioneered yet a new model. And same with Dan Biederman at Bryant Park. And we were lucky to have a willing partner. You know, Bloomberg was willing, even though we had never done this before, was willing to see us as a credible partner.
In addition to help from Betsy, you also received help from a couple of classmates of yours from Princeton, one of whom was Gifford Miller.
Yeah, so Gifford was actually my boyfriend's roommate in college. When I first called up Gifford, he was a city council person, I think one of the youngest city council person ever elected at the time. And he said, well, that's a really stupid idea.
No, to you.
Yeah. And he said, why don't you call Christine Quinn? She's a local city council. You know, he was basically pawning me off. And Christine was actually much more supportive. But then we got Gifford to go up there, and Gifford really fell in love with it. And then another one of my best friends from college, Mario Palumbo, became our treasurer. He helped get his boss on board, a guy named Phil Ahrens. And he was a developer, and he helped give us a lot of credibility because all the developers in the neighborhood and the city thought it was a bad idea. So here was a really successful New York developer that was saying, this makes sense.
Robert Caro, or Bob Caro, who's the author of Power Broker, a book about Robert Moses, he came up with you one day to look at the High Line, and that was sort of one of your personal high points in all this. How come?
Well, I got a message on my machine, you know, from Bob Caro, and I was just over the moon, you know. And I took him and his wife up on a tour of, you know, when the High Line was still wild. And he was so excited about the project, and he was so complimentary to me. And that's when it really first started sinking in that, wow, I might be doing something really special. I read his book right when I moved to New York. It's such a great primer on everything about New York. Mm-hmm. And there's a great section in The Power Broker where it talks about how Robert Moses builds the West Side Improvement Project, which was part of the High Line. And it cost $150 million in 1930, so equivalent to the Big Dig, you know, now. And he goes through several pages about how he got the money piece by piece by piece. And I'm not a real Robert Moses fan, but it was also just sort of inspiring to see, you know, it doesn't come at once. You don't have to see how you're going to get the money. And so I always kept those pages, you know, by my, I'd Xeroxed them, and they were, you know, by my desk.
In that way, you're similar to Robert Moses, but Robert Caro, who went up there, actually thought that your project was the inverse of something Moses would do.
Yeah, I mean, he liked the irony that it was helped created by a Robert Moses project, but that Robert Moses would probably not have liked it.
Why?
You know, because it was a bottom-up project. You know, Robert Moses' project were the ultimate projects of top-down, you know, of government authority pushing it through, you know, against community support, where this project really started in the community and then sort of bubbled up.
You raised $150 million for phase one and two of the project. And this, by the way, the project was full steam ahead really during an economic crisis in 2008, 2009. Mm-hmm. What were your thoughts about that? Did you ever feel, you know, maybe this money could be used for schools? Or what was your psychology around that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we realized early on, and a guy who's also one of the people that's been really important to the project, a guy named John Alschuler, helped us do an economic feasibility study and to show how this would become an economic generator for the city. And, you know, that it wasn't, that it really made economic sense, that this was a good investment. And it's turned out to be, you know, true beyond our wildest dreams. You know, it's generated over $2 billion in development already. And we estimate it'll be about $900 million that'll be returned to the city in additional real estate taxes over 20 years.
People have said about you that you are a superior marketer, and that obviously, you know, that helped.
Yeah. You know, I think to me, one of the things that was important for me was the graphic identity and sort of graphics, which Paula Scher did our logo, you know, a few months after we started, and it's now the logo for the park. And so in a very early stage, we put a real emphasis on the graphics, and it was twofold. One, to make people think we had more going on than we did and that they'd want to get involved, but it was also that it was a commitment that we were going to follow through on good design.
And this is at a time when, you know, Steve Jobs and Apple are, you know, gaining acceleration. You have the iPod. How much of that was in your thoughts?
I remember those iPod. We actually knocked off one of those early iPod ads for one of our events. But it was a commitment that we weren't just going to put up a planter and put up a stair and call it a day.
You look a little bit, I think, like Jimmy Stewart, you know, and he was in this movie Rear Window by Alfred Hitchcock. And I actually think of Rear Window when I'm walking on the High Line, because it's about just being up close with your neighbors. And you have people walking on the High Line and, you know, peeping in. People are voyeurs like myself. And, you know, we like to see what's going on in the residences around you. Talk to me a little bit about, you know, that dynamic.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things we really we loved about when we first heard the design team is in their first interview. One, I love because they were arguing amongst themselves in their interview, which I liked. But they also used the word, I think Liz Diller used it, was the word illicit. You felt like you were doing something, you know, not like hardcore illegal, but, you know, like riding your bike the wrong way on a street or something. And then, you know, right after we opened, the first big scandal was that The New York Post did a big story about, you know, people standing on the High Line watching people have sex in the Standard Hotel, which is right above the High Line, which is a little bit, I mean, I look all the time and I never see it, but, you know, so it's become almost like an urban myth, and you'll see tourists just planted, staring up, you know, waiting for something, hoping something's going to happen in the hotel windows. But, you know, I also think, usually when you go up in buildings in New York, you go to the Empire State Building, you know, you're at this high vantage point and people look like ants. The High Line, you're just, you know, 30 feet above the street. So you can make eye contact with people on the street. It has this very different feeling and experiencing the city. It makes the city almost look quainter, not as majestic.
By the way, what do you do as a hobby?
I used to be more of a painter. I didn't study it, but I started sort of taking it up in the 90s. And right before I started the High Line, I'd had a few very, very small shows. And but lately, I haven't been painting that much.
You meditate daily. What kind of meditation do you do, and what does it do for you?
It's just a mantra-based meditation. It's so I learned to meditate, you know, several years ago, and it's just I do it 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes in the afternoon. And I always hit, I think like most people, this sort of a low or this wall, you know, I don't know, some glucose shortfall, you know, around 3 or 4. And so I originally would go back. We had an old storage closet, and I would go back there to meditate. And gradually more and more people at the office have learned, and now there's almost 10 of us. And a lot of us, you know, every day at around 4 or sometimes 6, we'll go back in the storage closet and meditate together.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. My guest has been Robert Hammond, co-founder of The High Line. Coming up, we'll meet Aya Badir, founder of Little Bits. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Aya Badir, founder of Little Bits, a hardware company that produces electronic modules that snap together with magnets. These electronic modules are accessible to both children and adults, and the company's goal is to encourage creativity and invention by making electronics easier to use. Little Bits was launched in 2011, and the kits are sold in more than 70 countries. Aya graduated with a degree in computer engineering from American University in Beirut and has a master's from the MIT Media Lab. Aya is also an interactive artist. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You grew up in Lebanon. You were always encouraged down the engineering route. How come?
So I actually wanted to be a designer when I was in school, but I was very good at math and science. And so my family, my parents and my teachers told me that I owed it to myself to be an engineer. And I went into engineering because it was sort of the thing to do. But very quickly, I realized that engineering was very dry and very much not creative. And I felt like there was a big piece of my brain, like the creative portion, that was really not engaged. And so those were the seeds of some of the work that I ended up doing with Little Bits.
And also, you are an interactive artist, meaning that you are using technology in your art. Mm. And your focus is on perceptions of Arabian identity. One of your works is Arabia. Tell me about that.
So that was a project that came from a personal place. I had moved to the U.S. For a couple of years and more frequently than I thought, I would get comments from people that say, "Oh, you're Arab. How come you're not wearing a veil? Oh, you're Arab. Are you able to belly dance?" And I would get these like very polarized cliches thrown at me all the time. And I'd never thought of these things when I was growing up. And so Arabiya was basically a piece that I developed for a fashion show. It's a belly dancing outfit, and you have the model, the dancer, comes out to the stage and performs this really beautiful, very sensual dance. And then at one point, she flips a switch on her outfit, and through motors, the outfit starts to close on itself and turns into a burqa, just showing these two extremes of stereotypes associated with Arab women.
You're using technology and electronics in your artwork, playing with the two, and that's what you're encouraging people to do through little bits, basically, just to create and be inventive. What are some examples of some of the projects that the general public creates with little bit kits?
At the root, what we are doing, our mission is to put the power of electronics in everyone's hands and make anyone an inventor. We've been described as Lego for electronics or Lego for the 21st century. So they are bricks that instead of being plastic are lights and sounds and sensors and motors. And with the same ease, you can start using them. Kids have used them to learn about electronics or to create line-following robots. They've created, yesterday we saw a kid who made a flute that makes soap bubbles as he's blowing into the flute through a fan and some sensors. Also things that, you know, there's a lot of energy and attention towards the Internet of Things now. And we do have, with little bits, this ability to attach the Internet to anything so that you can bring appliances or devices at home to life and make them controllable with your phone. So we've seen people, for example, make something like a remote pet feeder so that if you're at home at the office and your pet is hungry, you can, through your phone, press a button and have a little motor turn a cup of food for your pets so you can feed them remotely.
You, in 2008, came up with the idea or the early prototypes for Little Bits, but it wasn't until 2011 that you actually launched the company. And it was your boyfriend who encouraged you to kind of stop everything else that you were doing. What's the story there?
So in about April 2011, I had been working on Little Bits as a project, as one of my projects for a few years, and I had gone and found a factory to make it, and I was doing prototypes. And in April 2011, I got the first shipment of a prototype from a factory that I'd been working with in China. And for the first time, I basically saw that Little Bits was manufacturable. And simultaneously, I'd been getting a good amount of press that was interested in the concept of kind of making electronics accessible to kids and adults. And so people would write in wanting to place orders. And so my boyfriend said, you have a product that's manufacturable and you have a customer that wants it. You need to stop everything else you're doing and start a company. And it was kind of like, oh, yeah, why not?
Is he still your boyfriend?
He's my husband now, yes.
Where did you meet him?
I met him in New York, actually. He co-curated a show with MoMA, with Paola Antonelli, called Design and the Elastic Mind, that was about design and science. He was chairing the conference, and I was giving a talk there.
In 2011, shortly after you launched, there was an exhibit at MoMA, or the Museum of Modern Art, where Little Bits was displayed, and Little Bits is now in the permanent collection. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. So there was an exhibit called Talk to Me by Paola Antonelli, who's the head design curator. And the exhibit was about the interaction between people and things. And Little Bits was on display in that exhibit. And it was a huge, huge honor because it was with some of the greatest design and technology pieces of the day. Shortly thereafter, they sent me an email saying that they wanted to acquire Little Bits into the permanent collection of the museum.
One of the germs for Little Bits was the creation of the concrete brick, which you've talked about before, invented in 1868. What is the connection of the concrete brick to your modules?
I believe that, you know, the world keeps changing and the technologies of the day are moving fast. And so in the early 1900s, the technology of the day was a concrete brick. That was the way we started to build larger, more complex structures, one brick at a time. And a little bit after, after, Lego came out with a play version of that brick in order to empower young and the young at heart to be able to play with that technology that was really ruling the world and be able to make buildings and bridges and these beautiful structures one brick at a time.
And they were called the automatic bonding brick?
Automatic bonding brick was the first name that they had. And now the world has changed again. Now the brick is no longer a cement brick. The brick is now a transistor, which is something that is driving all the technologies around us, the devices we carry, our phones, our alarm systems. They all, at their node, have a transistor. And so what is the play or the imagination version of that brick? How can we put that in the hands of the kids and kids at heart so that they can kind of understand the world and reinvent it? And that's sort of what drove a lot of the work on Little Bits.
What were a few pivot points for you, for the company, where you felt like you were getting traction from the public?
MoMA was definitely one. In September 2011, basically it was the day I launched the company, and at the same time we were acquired into the Permanent Collection. So it really kind of started us off on a really strong footing and with a lot of confidence and kind of a big stage to play on. And then in February 2012, I became a TED Fellow and I gave a talk at TED, which was also a pivotal moment. It was really a chance to talk about why this is important and why this is important for society, not as a gadget or a toy. It's important as a new way of thinking.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Aya Badir, founder of Little Bits, a company that sells electronic modules that snap together using magnets. These modules are generally easy to use, making them appealing to the general population, both adults and children. The company was started in 2011, and the kits are sold in more than 70 countries. Aya is also an interactive artist raised in Beirut, Lebanon.
You asked actually on pivotal moments. There is one more. Early on in the company, when we launched, we got an email from NASA, from the education department at NASA, saying that they wanted to collaborate with us to create kits to make space and Earth exploration more attractive to kids. And they came to us saying, you know, we need your help. And that was a huge moment. And we collaborated together to create a kit called the Space Kit, which replicates some, to a high degree of fidelity, some experiments that are happening at NASA that make this wonder around space and Earth more palatable and more understandable.
What's an example?
You know, in order to wake up astronauts in the space station, NASA sends wirelessly some music to play music as an alarm, and we have a little experiment where you have a microphone and you're playing music from your phone or an MP3 player, and you're transmitting this wirelessly through infrared to a speaker somewhere else.
Ironic that your family really pushed you hard to become an engineer and go down this route, and you did it resentfully as you really wanted to pursue your art, and now you're back where you started.
Absolutely.
With a twist.
Yeah, with a twist.
What does your mother make of this?
My mother has been a huge, huge influence and inspiration on me. When I was growing up, she was doing her master's when I was about 6 or 8. So I would come home and we would do homework together. And so even though I grew up in the Arab world, I never had any idea that there was sort of a different career choices that women and men made. And she's very supportive today as well.
You are part of the maker movement or the open hardware movement. Can you describe that?
The maker movement is really a movement that started around this idea that we should not be just consuming objects around us, that humans were made to be creative and to make with their hands. And that's how you learn. It's how you connect with friends. It's how you invent. And the maker movement is all about sort of making things for yourselves, whether it's arts and crafts, whether it's making electronics. It's really about putting the power back in the hands of the people instead of just the large companies. I do remember kind of early in the 2000s, you started to really see a world where everything was a screen and everything was virtual and every relationship was happening online. And for a lot of people, myself included, that's not a pretty world that I would like to live in. I believe in the tactile. I believe in feeling the satisfaction of having made something. And so what happened is I think that we realized that software in kind of the cloud or in virtual space, without it being on objects and in objects around us, becomes really intimidating and almost in not human. And so now the pendulum swung back again to say, all of the things we learned from software, how can we now embed them into devices of all sizes and spaces that are around us?
You attended the iBeam Art and Tech Center in New York. How important was that in the evolution of Little Bits? And what is it?
iBeam is an art and technology lab and center in New York. That was a very, very, very pivotal moment in my life. I had done engineering, and then I went to the media lab at MIT and was doing sort of engineering and art and doing a lot of research around that subject. And then I graduated in 2006 and got a job in finance. And I did finance for 2 years, and I was very, very miserable. And I didn't want to be doing PowerPoints and meeting with hedge funds. And so I quit, and I got a fellowship at iBeam. And at iBeam, I picked up these ideas of incorporating electronic with arts. And then Little Bits was a second project, just to think about, you know, how do I put this ability to use electronics for creativity? How do I put this ability in the hands of other people, not just myself? Which is sort of the genesis of Little Bits.
In addition to selling these modules, the community aspect of Little Bits has really developed. You have something called a Maker Hub, where people are on your site sharing what they've made, as well as BitLab, which is basically an app store for hardware.
So on the first piece, the community, basically, you know, because Little Bits is essentially a system of these electronic bricks, you know, the point is not the bricks, the point is what you make with them. And so we have a space on the website where there are thousands of projects that people have uploaded with step-by-step tutorials for things you can make. You then have kids that are 8 years old and adults that are 45 years old collaborating on an idea.
What's an example?
We have one of our community members that made basically a surf weather alert because he wanted to know when it was a good tide to go surfing. And so basically connected this motor to make a display that's on a beach that reads from weather data to get like high tide, low tide, and basically creates these notifications that go back and forth and tell him now it's a good time to surf. And that's an example of a collaboration that was across different ages and experiences.
I want to talk about the design of the product. They're white circuit boards with very colorful connectors, pink and blue and green. Can you talk to me about some of those choices?
Electronics are always ugly. They're always green or black, and there's wires sticking out everywhere. And they're the thing you put inside something. You make a shell around it to cover them. And part of sort of the challenge was, how do you make electronics not intimidating? How do you make them inviting? And so one of the tools to cross that hurdle is to make them beautiful, make them exposed so they're open. They're not hidden under any box. They're white because it's less sort of scary. They have this handwritten font on them because it makes them feel human. And they have these neon-colored connectors because we want them to be gender-neutral. People gravitate towards them that never would have put their hand on electronics, whether it's kids, particularly young girls, but also entrepreneurs, designers, artists, people that have no engineering training whatsoever or no interest in engineering.
You mentioned gender-neutral. Neutrality. In what ways are you mindful of encouraging girls to pick up the product?
Getting more girls and women into technology is a hidden agenda of the company, but we don't wear it on our sleeve. What we do is make very, very deliberate choices to make sure that the product, the communication around the product, and everything the company stands for is egalitarian.
I want to talk about venture capital for a moment. You've raised a couple...
So fun.
You've raised a few rounds of venture capital. What have been your impressions of that process along the way?
Raising money is not easy in general. But in addition to that, raising money for a hardware company is difficult. I remember early on in one of my pitches, one investor, very, very prominent investor, told me, I love your business. I love everything you're doing. I think it's going to be a smashing success, but I can't invest in you. Your business is too much of a real business for us. There is the reality. There's physical product and raw material and shipping and taxes and warehouses. And, you know, the barrier to being successful is much higher than making a piece of software and getting a million people to use it. So the hardware component adds to the complexity of raising money. I don't actively think about it, but there is an extra stigma of being a woman.
What is one example?
I'd rather not proliferate the anecdotes, and instead I'll say what I learned and what I think is a proactive way to solve it. I think that the generation before us fought a very hard fight, and we stand on their shoulders for being able to do the things that we're able to do. But now we have a different fight to fight, which is do great work. And I think that the best way to succeed is something that actually Sarah Silverman said once in one of her shows, which is just be undeniable. Be undeniable. And then nobody can come in and say, but she's a woman. It will not happen. And then the third reason why it's difficult to raise money is I got a good piece of advice early on, which is not all money is equal. You can get money from anywhere, but getting the right kind of money or smart money is transformative.
Your modules allow you to do a whole array of things, of one of which most recently is to make music. And you have all these modules in front of me. Can you make some music for me?
Sure. So what I have is a power bit, which is blue, and I'm going to snap it into an oscillator, which is generating the sound wave, and a speaker. And now I'm tuning the oscillator. And then I can put a keyboard. Add a sequencer.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Aya Badir, founder of Little Bits. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.